Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, proudly presented by Butler Snow, where we cover topics of interest to lawyers handling appellate matters in Texas courts and beyond. This podcast demystifies appellate law and pulls back the curtain on the appellate system through conversations with judges, court staff, and top trial and appellate practitioners. Listen in to discover best practices and tips for successfully presenting your case, managing your docket, and promoting efficiency through legal technology. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
In today's episode, we're going to share our conversation with our friend, MC Sangaila from California. MC is the host of the Portia Project podcast, and she's been on our show a couple of times before. But Jody, we were in the sort of unique position of recording an episode of her podcast where MC interviewed us. And so we decided to release that as an episode of the Texas Appellate Law Podcast as well.
Mm-hmm. And we kind of co-interview each other. We each kind of share our reflections on podcasting and all the things that have brought us to this point and all of that. So it goes both ways.
That's true. And so we look forward to sharing our thoughts through the filter that is MC on podcasting. We've certainly enjoyed our experience for now 115 or so episodes as co-hosts of our podcast. And so if you want to know what we've gotten out of podcasting and what our approach is to podcasting, then please continue to listen. And MC's discussions of what she's gone through and her 100 episodes of the Portia Project podcast are really interesting as well. So please stay tuned.
And today I'm very pleased to report that we have a joint special episode between the Portia Project podcast and the Texas Appellate Law podcast. And so I want to welcome both of the co-hosts of that podcast, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders.
Thanks for having us, MC. We're really happy to be here.
Yeah, agreed.
We know we don't fit the demographics of your normal Portia Project guests, and we're really grateful.
Well, I think that both of you were instrumental in the Portia Project coming into life and being present. You had such a quality production and podcast, and it was really inspiring, the work that you have done, and it kind of pushed me towards doing the podcast myself. So I feel like as we're at the 100 episode mark for Portia Project, and you all have exceeded that as well, I thought it was a good time to kind of sit down and talk about our podcasting journeys and maybe the combined knowledge and information that we've learned from our various guests in both of our podcasts. So it'd be like getting the wisdom of like 200 episodes together.
A lot of wisdom in there passed along by people other than the three of us. So
yes, absolutely.
Exactly.
Well, congratulations on hitting 100 episodes. That's a significant milestone. You've done it very quickly. I was going to say much faster than we did. I mean, I know when you first started, you were just going great guns, recording constantly, and you had quite a stockpile of episodes. So have you been able to maintain a good clip as far as keeping content coming and staying ahead of your publication schedule?
It's really, for me, driven by the guests and those they continue to recommend or suggest to me. And so the pace was driven by the people who are willing to come on, many of them justices, state Supreme Court justices, who wanted to be part of the project. So I moved faster and had a lot more interviews in a row because I didn't want to have it be that it was interviewed in February of 2022 and their episode wouldn't come out until mid-2023. So I wanted to make sure that we got all of that done and out. So yeah, it's still ahead of schedule, still have quite a few episodes recorded and ready to go. And in total at this point, on the judge side, 32 different state Supreme Courts of different states will be represented on the podcast. So I'm going for 50, but we're at 32.
That's amazing.
I feel really inadequate.
Oh.
We actually have more than one Supreme Court that we've done, though, even though we're Texas-centered. We've exceeded our quota, I suppose. But yeah, that's pretty, I mean, that's just darn impressive to have that many. And what a great to hear from and get wisdom from, not only about being women in the law and women on the bench, but just general knowledge of appellate related stuff, which I know isn't really necessarily the focus on your show quite the same way it is as ours, but still great. Lots of good content and opportunity, especially for the target demographic. I mean, you're trying to encourage women to not only become lawyers, but also judges. And so that's really fantastic.
Yeah. Thank you, Todd. I appreciate that. Yeah. I'm really happy with serving as the facilitator for this, for those who want to share their stories. And we hope we have an impact on others as a result of sharing them. And I think that's one of the things, like I said, I just want to be the conduit for what clearly is resonating with people, both with the judges and those who are listening. So we both have a range of guests. I do have a lot of judicial guests, but a lot of people in other roles inside and outside the law. So let's talk about the judges first, because you've had a lot of judges on your podcast too. For me, at least, we were talking about before we pushed record, that there's certainly a lot of things that we know that, especially as appellate advocates, that are good things to do, best tips or practices in brief writing or argument. But at least my experience has been having talked to many appellate judges in many different courts where I haven't even appeared yet, there's a more than a common thread about things that they're interested in seeing. It's more like I have seen through their lens what they need to do in order to decide the cases. And for example, where oral argument sits in that process for them, that I'm really forever changed, I think, in how I look at what we're doing as advocates for the courts. I don't know if you guys have had this similar experience, like you have this aha, like, oh, the way I think about this and my job is very different now.
Yeah, I don't know that it's changed the way I think about it, but I think it has continually reinforced for me getting to the point. And I think that's one of the things that both advocates and judicial guests have stressed. And it's easy to forget that because as the advocate, you get so deep into the case, you know it probably better than just about anyone. But the judge who's going to get it, whether it's on a Supreme Court, an intermediate court of appeals, whatever it is, even the trial court, it's going to be one of many that they probably have zero context for. And I think so many of them have reminded me, look, give us something short and upfront to help us orient ourselves and figure out why this case matters and what matters to us. And I have heard that time and time again, different ways of delivering that message. But that's something that I've taken and something I've really tried to incorporate in what I do, whether it's a motion hearing in a trial court, an oral argument at the Court of Appeals, or in the way I do a brief. Okay, let's figure out what is my distilled elevator speech that this case is going to be about. And I need to kind of keep that upfront and kind of keep it to what I'm doing.
Yeah, it's been reinforced for me too. In fact, I was just sitting down with one of my partners yesterday because we've been asked to do an in-house sort of seminar with our younger lawyers here in the office. And that was one of the things we talked about was the lesson that's carried through that, in addition to being something I've learned on the podcast, but that I've heard many judges say over time, which is get to the point, as Jody was suggesting, but make the decision maker's job easy. Let them know upfront what it is you're asking them to do. That applies, I think, really no matter what kind of written advocacy you're engaged in. We're going to be speaking to our younger lawyers about it in the context of trial court motions primarily, because that's a lot of what they're doing. But the same lesson applies across really almost any form of written advocacy, whether it's a memo, an internal memo on a big case for an institutional client that's going to be applied across different actual cases, or a trial court motion, or an appellate brief, or anything like that. So I think I was okay at that before, but that really now has just been cemented into my brain that this is something that you really need to do, because it doesn't really matter what level the court sits at. The job is still to get their attention quickly and let them know exactly what the case is about.
Well, and to think about, yeah, from their perspective, whether you're trial court or appellate, you're moving between cases pretty quickly. And just to get that orientation, like, what am I dealing with? Okay, a summary judgment in an employment case on this. Okay, good. All right, now, what's the issue?
We like to ask a lot of our Supreme Court guests, particularly, what part of the brief you read first. And for almost all of them lately, it's been the statement of the case, which to me is more of a throwaway. You think, okay, this is a short little technical, but they all read it first because it gives them that sort of blurb that they need. Okay, what's this case about? What's the issue that I'm looking at? And what's the action that's at issue here? And I find myself spending a lot more time on that than I used to, where it was like, okay, let's just kind of cut and paste the procedural details. And now I really think about, okay, what needs to be in here? What's truly important that I want them to see? If this is the first place they're going to turn, where do we go?
When the stakes are high, decisions must be made quickly, and Court Surety Bond Agency is here to help. As the nation's leading surety agency specializing in supersedious bonds, CSBA can handle any size bond, ranging from a small temporary injunction bond to a billion-dollar appeal bond. If your client needs protection against judgment enforcement, contact CSBA or visit courtsurety.com today.
That's interesting. I think that answer is really varied between the different folks that I've talked to. And there's one thing that I always thought would be like the table of contents of each of those. That's my way of getting into the briefs just personally. And then I'll generally read the reply brief first. So I kind of see where the fight is and then sort of work backwards. But every judge has a different way, like which part they're reading first. Like you said, some of them could say statement of the case. You're like, okay, well, I really need to like kind of up my game in that department.
Yeah, exactly.
And you just never know like which your judge might do something differently. So my sense is like, well, you need to have your game upped kind of everywhere, but just paying attention to it because you never know what the entry point would be that particular judge uses. The second thing that I learned was that sometimes the entry point isn't even the brief for many of them. Many of them say, well, I start with the opinion I'm reviewing. I want to read what the district judge said or the trial court said or the court of appeals said if it's the Supreme Court. And that's where I start. I start with the judge's decision. And then I move to the briefs from there. So that's kind of an interesting wrinkle. I always think of them starting with the brief first, but you have to think, yeah, sometimes they might start with the opinion.
That's true. Although for a lot of our intermediate courts of appeals here, our Texas trial courts don't issue kind of written orders. So it's nice because they rarely start with that other than just,
yeah,
you know, the order says granted or denied.
Because that's where they have to go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Orders granting summary judgment are typically pretty short and to the point here for several reasons. But the last Supreme Court justice that we interviewed did exactly what Jody suggested. She said statement of the case, and then I think went straight to, from there, the next thing was the Court of Appeals opinion, which I thought was an interesting progression. As an advocate, I'm generally starting with the order that I'm taking up or defending, but then you have to craft those other things based in part on that order. And I'm like Jody, in the statement of the case part, we, many years ago, we kind of went to this tabled statement of the case that is really not anything to look at. But it's still, even though you're not supposed to be argumentative according to the rules in that section of our briefs in Texas, it still does give you the chance to kind of lay out the things that you think the court needs to know about the case. And some of those are, they can be stated fairly objectively and in a way that does exactly what we're saying. It gives the court the basic information it needs to orient itself to what it's about to be asked to do without necessarily making a lot of editorial comment about the weight of evidence or something like that. I see people do that still, even despite the fact that our rules say don't. And so it's just kind of a sign of an inexperienced appellate advocate to see a lot of attempted advocacy in that part of the brief. But anyway, it's definitely been something I've honed my skill in developing because I do know how important it is. And it's just been reinforced by our conversations with our judges.
Yeah, I think probably in the category of the most like significant impact of what I heard from the judges about this is an oral argument. And it was Judge Millett on the DC Circuit, who was an amazing appellate advocate, U.S. Supreme Court advocate before going on the bench. And so I thought she'd have an interesting perspective in particular saying, is there something you know now being an appellate judge that you really wish you'd known that you'd have a different perspective of when you were an advocate? And she said one of the things was that as an advocate, oral argument is the end. That's the end of the case for you until the decision comes and you do something. It's like oral argument is just part of the process as the judge. Like things just get started after argument for us. So if you think about that, about where that argument is in the process for the judges who are deciding your case, you're going to think about oral argument very differently. It's not the end. It's just the beginning for them in terms of asking questions to you to get answers and sort of kind of that triangular thing that happens sometimes between one justice talking to another justice through the advocate. And then they're conferencing and they're discussing this. And I don't know, it just really made me think, yeah, their perspective is very different. That's not the end. And how can you help them have the information that they need to engage in those discussions with their colleagues and get to a conclusion that's hopefully favorable to your client? So I don't know. And just thinking about that, put yourself in their shoes, quite literally, about what that is.
Yeah, I like that. I hadn't really thought about it in that context, but I do like that.
Yeah, it was one of those, I was like, oh, she definitely knows both. So what would she think? And it was like, yeah, just that, what part of the process it is for the judges. Just knowing that or thinking about that when you're engaging in it might change your perspective a little. So that was my big aha.
It's not necessarily the end of the process for anyone who just can't stand having the last word, but
well, that okay, that could
ordinarily
yeah. Looks like Todd's thinking about something that happened recently in that regard.
I don't think asked anyone about like post-submission briefs as an advocacy tool, but certainly they do have a place when, yeah, the best example I can think of off the top of my head about post-submission briefs is just dealing with, say, a question at oral argument that wasn't a good answer to at the time, or it was something that was addressed by your opposing counsel and you didn't have much time, like you're the appellee and it came up in rebuttal and you couldn't address it. So there's situations like that, but I just was thinking to myself about, is it really the last though?
Well, in most cases, it could be it's the last, but you're right. Yeah, there could still be some volleying back and forth. So those are kind of, that gets to our guest brief writing and oral argument. I think those are both two good kind of takeaway tips from all of them. What about guests and their careers? I think one of the things that has really struck me the most that's been really universal for all of the guests on my podcast has been two things. First is that you see the shiny outcome of their careers. And I think that if you didn't talk to them, you would think that everything was shiny all along. And the answer is it was not. There were dark parts of the journey. There were tough things. There were things where they didn't know where they were going to go, but they've managed to pull it all together and there it is at the end. So I think it's very encouraging, I think, and like human to see that even for people who are on the Supreme Court, there were moments of uncertainty and challenges in their career. Even some of them talked about when they were asked to apply, like when the opening came up on the court and they may have been dealing with a lot of things personally, something going on in their family, something where they would have otherwise said, this is not a good time. But they said, you know what? This is the time, right? This is the time when there's an opportunity. So I'm going to take it despite all of these other things going on. And I think that's just inspiring to people generally, whether you're looking to become a judge or any of the roles that these people are, that you can have success ultimately, even when there's a lot of challenges along the way. And sometimes those challenges, overcoming them, gives you the skills you need to succeed in the end. So I think there's something about that sort of universally.
I think that's right. And I think we've seen a lot that when you think of sort of the traditional path to being a successful appellate advocate and clerkships and all that, I think that's true. But I think we've also seen that you can be a tremendously successful advocate and not take that path and still get to the same end result.
Yeah, we've had probably two or three guests that we actually, that was one of the features of their interview, was that they were taking a non-traditional path to becoming an advocate, an appellate advocate. And kind of the same too with some of our judges. I mean, in terms of sort of being transparent and offering some stories of resilience, more than one judge we have interviewed has wound up in their current position after losing a previous election. And so staying with it and winding up having a really good outcome for themselves and being appointed to a higher office and then getting elected. So we've had a lot of that actually. And I've been pleasantly surprised and happy with how many of our guests really will kind of show more of themselves than you get like going to a CLE or something like that. Because of the nature, I think, of like this conversation, we're having a three-way conversation over Zoom. It feels more intimate, even though they know that people are going to be listening and it could be 1,000 people or more that hear the episode. They're more willing to share. Some of them you have to kind of get over the hump. Like we've had a few that wanted to know the outline. Well, okay, what questions are you going to ask me? But once we kind of steer them to some other episodes and they reach a comfort level and know that they're not going to be on the hot seat, at least not for very long with us. So...
Yeah, that it's a positive experience. It's not meant to be a gotcha moment. So yeah, Exactly.
Well, I was going to say another kind of takeaway that threads between, I think, both types of guests, the advocates and the judges, is there's not really a universally right way to be an advocate. I think there's some universal wrong ways, but there's people that have so many different styles and ways of doing things that do a really good job. And it's kind of been fun to see the different ways that they go about it and think, huh, I'd never thought of doing it that way, but that works. And kind of finding what's authentic to you.
Yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah, different perspectives.
Yeah. Well, that brought to mind that I was thinking the other thing that I've seen too is that it's always when you go looking backwards at the careers that it makes complete sense that they ended up where they did. They have this particular talent here and this particular talent there. And somehow where they've ended up is the perfect marriage of all of those talents. And somebody else who didn't have all of those things wouldn't be doing it nearly the way they are. And so it seems sort of inevitable. But because of the first part we talked about, it really wasn't.
Oh, no, there are very few straight paths in one's career in the law, right? Everybody has a speed bump somewhere along the way. Unless you're Jody Sanders and you go to work for a great firm and have a great mentor and you just stay on this up and to the right your whole career.
We'll see. If there's still a few years left.
There's still time is what you're saying.
Yeah. There's still time for that speed bump, Jody. Don't you worry.
Right. That's right. Not to say those haven't been there already.
Gosh.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's one of it too. I think, like you said, Todd, that people are willing to be much more forthcoming. And I think that, like you said, part of it is like the intimacy of the medium in a way. But also, I think they don't come on unless they're willing to share.
Well, to that point, with us, we were kind of shocked in the beginning of how much success we had getting good guests.
You did. Well, you started with your clerk of the Supreme Court, right? So that's a pretty good first guest. Yeah.
Well, our first actual guest was a sitting Texas Supreme Court justice who we got through our mutual friend who happens to be the clerk of the court. But I've said this many times, I think that gave us like immediate, instant credibility. And then we kind of go and tell people, hey, well, we had Justice Boyd on and Blake, the clerk of the court, Blake Hawthorne came on. So we must be legit. We're not just like some guys trying to get you on some weird show that nobody's going to pay any attention to. So, but you, I mean, you had the same kind of success. I mean, yours, the numbers that you shared earlier with us about having had 30 some odd state Supreme Courts represented among your guests are incredibly impressive. So I think we have found that having that kind of success and getting guests sort of snowballs on itself after a while, and people don't treat you like you're crazy, like you're trying to sell them something.
Yes, exactly. Well, I think especially for the judges, they're cautious, understandably. So I would be the same way, like, who is this person, right? So yeah, so I think it was the first sort of dozen guests who I knew who did the recordings with no podcast out there at all. So that was like deep faith that I was going to treat them fairly and that it was going to be a good podcast and everything. But from them and those experiences came the next guests. And it just sort of, like you said, snowballed on itself. And then once they were out there, then looks legit, right? Okay, we'll say okay to do this. Look at all these other amazing people who have agreed to sit down and chat.
Well, in terms of getting guests also, I mean, there is that kind of people make referrals, as you've said, and we've definitely taken advantage of that. There's still people on our list that we need to reach out to that were referrals that definitely want to have on the show. One strategy that I've used sort of unintentionally, but it's been very effective, is if I go to a CLE and it's a topic that's relevant potentially, or if I went to an event last night and targeted a judge, and not even intentionally, I just, after chatting with this judge for a while, I was like, he'd be a really good guest on our podcast. So would you consider coming on? And she actually knew about it, and she's not an appellate judge. She's a trial judge, but we love having trial judges on our show. So she said yes. So we look forward to that and recording those kinds of episodes. But it's just those sort of chance conversations that I find are really effective in terms of being able to get other guests that maybe don't necessarily fall within the narrow parameters of Texas appellate law, but still we can have really interesting conversations. And as we always say, learn something new from talking to that person.
Yeah, the referrals of the current guests, that's definitely one, or past guests, that's definitely one of the avenues.
For most clients, a supersedious bond is something they may need once in a lifetime, and very few surety brokers specialize in supersedious bonds. If your client needs to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, Court Surety Bond Agency is the company to call. Learn more by visiting courtsurety.com today.
One of the things that I think is interesting about a podcast, which is different from writing a book or an article or something, is that it evolves. It sort of naturally evolves both with from the guests that you're having and also sort of the direction that the podcast itself is going, or even it's a highly personal thing too. I think kind of where your interest is, and then you say, oh, well, I'm interested in this. I think other people might be interested in this, and we'll kind of go this direction. So in my case, I started with women appellate judges. So I started with that. But then I thought, well, what other kinds of judges, like how you apply to become a judge, or even whether you're elected or appointed, that varies from state to state. It varies from the different levels of court, magistrate judges versus district court judges, all of that. So I started thinking outside that box. Then it started growing to what are the other ways that women are leading in the profession, off the bench and in other ways, and even outside the profession. And then it ultimately led to, if I were in law school, like what other kinds of careers and things are there out there that I would like to know about that I'm not going to learn through career services? Like this is just vast, the number of ways you can use your law degree. And so I started branching out to like legal design and just a number of new, really sort of cutting edge areas. Of course, general counsel, things like that. But that's kind of how it's evolved. And now it's pushing the envelope a little bit more, even towards women who are not in the law, but are C-suite business or otherwise, maybe chief marketing officers or otherwise, who have learned to navigate the business world. And they have a little different approach towards that than lawyers might. And sort of what can you learn from them and how they've navigated their path? So I've kind of even expanded a little bit outside the law, because I thought when we go multidisciplinary, that's when we start learning and kind of thinking outside the box about how we can do things. So that's nothing that could happen if it weren't a podcast. I mean, if it were a book, it would have to be, it's done and it's there. So I think that's one of the neat things about the medium.
We've had some legal tech folks come on. I mean, we always kind of try to at least have something of an appellate law angle to it, or maybe practice management angle, but it still winds up being a good conversation that we all learn something from. And I like that idea about the C-suite. If you had like maybe a client or someone like an in-house lawyer who would come on and talk about relations with their counsel, their outside counsel from a client perspective, something like that would be good. Or just, I mean, there's all kinds of possibilities.
Yeah, that's what, see, now you guys have new ideas for your podcast too. So I've had a couple of chief legal officers or general counsel of some major companies also on, which is, I think, thing to learn about how do you get to that point, what the difference between being in-house and outside counsel. And also, like I said, yeah, legal tech founders, legal design people from really all over the world, chief marketing officers, like I said, of some major companies like Unity 3D, the chief marketing officer who also worked at Apple and Google. She has a really different perspective. Her podcast is coming up later this year, but we've recorded already. So yeah, kind of thinking outside the box there. And also I'm hoping some CEOs who have law degrees. There aren't that many of public companies, but there are like maybe half a dozen female CEOs with law degrees. So that would be an interesting crossover too.
Well, yeah, because you always hear of all the things you can do with a law degree. And we all read a fair amount in terms of what are alternate careers that you can follow. And I think that's just as important to educate people about. And not everybody has to practice law just because you have a law degree, but it doesn't mean that having the law degree isn't significant and doesn't open doors for you in other ways. I think it clearly does. So I'm always interested in those stories.
Yeah, it's really interesting. Most of the people who are most conscious of what you're talking about, Todd, in terms of how they use their legal training and their thinking and analysis, are those who lead nonprofit organizations. Like the program chair of Girls Inc., who was on, the CEO of Caton Children's Museum, whose episode ran this week, the executive director of Project Hope Alliance, which deals with homeless youth. All of them are like very conscious. I mean, can articulate in ways that are highly specific about how they use their legal training to lead their organization, to understand risk, just how to think through problems. It's clearly something they've thought about. They're like, yes, it's useful. And also, Todd, it's useful for them, like in that context, they're like, well, we got a lot of legitimacy from that too. We have a law degree. We have certain level of respect that we are given in leading a nonprofit from having that training.
That is interesting. I always appreciate the sort of non-traditional legal paths.
Yeah, it's really interesting to hear that, to hear how they've evolved into that, or maybe that's something they plan to do going into law school. And then some of the academics are interesting too. The deans, like the dean of RAND's policy school is a lawyer. Doesn't have to be. She has a PhD also, but she was previously a dean of a law school. Who would think that you'd be like basically the dean of the training ground for a think tank? That wouldn't be something we'd think about. So it's been really interesting. And then of course, there's a few lawyer authors and things like that. So novelists, I think a lot of us hope have a novel in us or think we might. So
that's right. Especially the appellate lawyers of the world. I think that's what we are. Is we're all just frustrated novelists.
Exactly. And then I think also for me is like the historical development of what it shows in the history of women in the law from hearing the stories of people who were in law school in the 70s and early 80s, as opposed to moving to the current day, how quickly that change has happened, that there's more than one or two women in law school, and the Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Sandra Day O'Connor days are gone from not being able to get a job. And I think appreciating, you get a sense of appreciation of history and how fast it's changed. Listening to this, these are women who are still practicing or on the bench who had those experiences. Hope that gives insight and maybe appreciation of those who are just coming out of law school right now. Like, wow, at the front end, we've got a very different experience than those who had far more challenges to begin with, but still ended up being on the bench. So
I'm privileged as a Anglo male in our society, but I always find those stories inspiring because I have my own perspective and a natural, I don't want to say biases because I don't mean it to be in a negative thing, but it makes me respect the folks that had to climb in that way even more. And of course, with more and more women in the profession, more and more women on the bench, it's easier to see. You're used to women in those positions, which I think it has to just set that example for even more women that are coming up. So a lot of great stories of folks literally climbing up from less than ideal circumstances to get to where they are. I just always enjoy hearing those.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the most popular episodes are Julia Smith Gibbons on the Sixth Circuit, Judge Lee Rosenthal from District Court in Texas, Diane Wood, those who were really the very beginning. Everybody's always sort of fascinated by those stories, even Christine Durham from the Utah Supreme Court. There's a lot to those. I say right now, I think Judge Gibbons is probably one of the most popular because she was a first in almost everything she did. So it's really interesting to just hear about that time. So yeah, it's pretty neat. And then also I think from this, you get, when people talk about diversity and inclusion and different backgrounds, the importance of having different backgrounds, I think experiences on the bench, I think it becomes, when you hear the stories and the different perspectives, you realize, yeah, that's important to have those different perspectives. I think the one that really resonated with me was a Washington Supreme Court Justice, Raquel Montoya Lewis, who was a tribal court judge before becoming a trial court judge and then moving up to the Supreme Court. And just thinking about and hearing her story of serving as the tribal court judge and understanding what that role is, which is really different from, I mean, you really have to understand the culture of that particular tribe. I mean, she was a tribal court judge for different tribes. And she's like, the job is different depending on which tribe and how you gain legitimacy of your decisions and mediate things is vastly different because it depends on the culture in which the court was brought up. Some of them, there's no authority. There's no statutes. There's no case law. It's sort of all oral transmission of what had happened before. Others were much more like our legal system. But understanding how each of those was created came out of the culture of that particular tribe. I think having that background, you're going to really look at the context in which you're making decisions on other benches differently. You're going to understand in a really intuitive way how all of that contributed to the legal system that's there. I just think it's a vastly different, interesting perspective.
It is. And that's a thread that has run through a lot of our episodes, is sort of the doors that have been closed to applicants of different backgrounds to appellate practice traditionally. And the people that are working, I think, to open those doors and maybe sort of create pipelines for populations mm-hmm. that didn't have access to appellate practice and really didn't know anything about it. One that stands out is Juveria Khan, who founded the Appellate Project, right. and just having her kind of bring into sharp focus the problems that our practice has with a lack of diversity and the things that she and so many other people are doing to kind of try and fix that. It was something that really has stuck with me. And it keeps coming up in many different episodes with many different guests, that same theme.
Just say from my own experience in appellate practice, when I first started, there were a lot more women in the practice because it didn't quite have the prestige, I guess, that some segments of the appellate practice have now. And it was easier to balance having a life. It wasn't like I'm in trial all week and I have no idea what's going to happen. So I can't schedule anything in my life or for my family or anything. And so there were more women in the profession at that point. But now that it's changed, we're back to not as many women. So I've even seen that evolve during the time I've been in appellate practice. It's kind of an interesting phenomenon. So we need to get back to having more wide array of folks practicing appellate law. And Juveria Khan's project is very focused on that and has a lot of people involved in it. A lot of the judges who've been on my program have mentioned that and said, oh, we're involved in that, or we're doing something to help foster that kind of encouragement. So I remember that episode. It was a good one on your podcast.
Well, my partner, the head of my practice group, and I have both taken on mentees from the Appellate Project. She was doing that, and Jody, I knew Jody had done that, but my partner, Amanda Taylor, she was already working on that, even aside from having Juveria on the podcast. But it was a really nice way to help publicize that wonderful program that she's built. And it's so nice to see the fruit of that firsthand in working with the mentee and watching Amanda's experience with hers too. Just little things like that make a difference, right?
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, I think that's what I hope the podcast does in itself, that it makes a difference in if you can't have that one-on-one mentoring situation, that you at least kind of get that through the podcast itself. And many of the guests have said they'll reach out to me. If anyone's curious about something, they're open to talking to people. I think the other thing that you touched upon in that is that a podcast being just part of a larger whole, like another tool in your toolkit of, like you said, you were able to hopefully elevate the knowledge of that particular project so more people could participate. That would have a ripple effect in the real world besides the particular podcast episode. I think the corollary of that for my podcast is the Girls Inc. episode that we did, live panel in person with 11th grade girls who were going through an internship training program in the summer with Girls Inc. in Orange County. And so there was the personal relationships and honestly, judges offering for these girls to come watch them in court and all of this that came out of that experience. But then being able to use the podcast to leverage that more than those 100 girls who were in the room would get to hear the knowledge of that panel and hopefully kind of ripple out and inspire more people down the road. So I think that's kind of one of the powers of the podcast is being able to leverage it out into ripple effects in the real world. It was so much fun to do. And it was so much fun because when you're there with the girls, they're like, oh my gosh, this is so amazing. And you're talking to 11th grade girls. So how you describe your career and what people do and things like that is just going to be different because you're thinking about it through a different lens. So I thought a lot of the participants thought it was very rewarding because they're like, yeah, I had to kind of go back to when I was in high school or college. What would I want to know? So I think it was a kind of a neat trip for them. And then also the camaraderie of having all of them together at once doing the podcast. Pretty neat. So since we're talking about podcasts and podcasting, maybe kind of close out with some tips for those who might want to start a podcast, what things they should think about or things I wish I'd thought about before I started this or things I wish I knew. Maybe if some of the things we knew, we might never have started it. So maybe we don't want to share everything.
I kind of came in knowing almost nothing. So it was pretty easy for me to say, I wish I had known a whole lot more. But I've talked to several people about starting a podcast, and kind of several of the things I tell them is map out quite a few episodes in advance. Think about what you want to do, what you want to cover, and kind of make your roadmap of the first 5 or 10 episodes. I know Todd has mentioned the stat that Very few podcasts get past 10 episodes. So if you can do that, you're already in a very small percentage of podcasts that are successful. So I think sit down and map out where you want to go for your first 5 to 10 episodes. And if you can, I mean, we can't all be like UMC, who just was able to kind of put so many in the can before you even really got started, which is amazing. But try and kind of get several of them going, because life does get in the way. And Todd and I were in some ways kind of lucky that we recorded our first couple of episodes together at the Texas Supreme Court. And then literally the next week, I think, was when COVID hit. So all of a sudden, we had a lot of time on our hands. All the judges had a lot of time on their hands, and everybody had a Zoom account. So life really didn't get in the way for the first year and a half almost of our podcast. And that was just a weird thing that happened that I think wouldn't have happened. I mean, trying to do weekly episodes now with what our lives are like, starting it from scratch would be incredibly hard. So I think if you're going to do it, map it out, think about where you want to go, maybe recruit your first few guests if you're going to do a guest one, and then maybe just record a few and see how you think they sound before you start putting them out there.
Yeah, having a plan is critical for sure. In my previous thinking about starting a podcast, I didn't really have a firm plan. That was one of the reasons why it never got going. So connecting with Jody made it easier. And one of the things I admire about you and your show, MC, is the fact that it's all you all the time. If I'm having a bad day, Jody can pick up the slack or vice versa, although we don't tend to have too many dead spots in our podcast. We manage to keep the conversation going, which is one of the half the battle, I guess, is what I would say. So yeah, the advanced planning, having the tech stuff down, which is kind of important, and that's worked out fine for us. Zoom is a great medium to record on, I think, but there's other mediums out there that you can use that are all pretty accessible, and you can just do a Google search and figure out what those are. But this has worked out great for us.
Yeah, it's worked for me too. I think it works for me. I try to make whatever's easy for the judges, and almost all the judges have Zoom. So that kind of decides which platform I'm going to use. They're like, oh, Zoom, we know that. I think some of the more really pro pros use Riverside to record theirs. That I've experienced for sure. But there's different strokes for different folks, as it were.
The upside I understand to Riverside is that it records to the hard drive separate files, so that if you had a hiccup in the internet connection, it can be spliced together and fixed easily. Very rarely, though, I mean, as long as everybody's internet is reasonably fast, Zoom has been just fine. And almost never has there been an issue.
Yeah. So you can record on separate audio files on Zoom on the computer, and that usually solves the problem for me. Yeah.
We do that too. So we've stuck with Zoom, and we have no plans to make any changes there at this point. But keeping an eye open, though, to who knows what will happen in the future. But I think your point about judges know Zoom is a really good one. We don't have to train them on how to join a Zoom call. I think that was one of the concerns. It would not really have been practical to think that we could record all of our episodes in person, especially if we're trying to, if we're covering a broad geographic area in terms of our guests. Would have been really impossible for you. So Zoom has been a great solution there. So we just kind of hit the perfect storm with the pandemic starting. We give a lot of credit, try to see the good that came out of COVID. Well, for us, it definitely helped us get started and build that momentum. It was a big benefit for us. Plus, people were just kind of thirsty for conversation.
Absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. Things. I was like,
including us.
Yeah, right. I was like, it's helpful for the guests. It was because they're like, oh, we want to talk to someone. And you're right, the judges weren't in court. That's my experience too. The first set of episodes I recorded was still during like yet another lockdown in California. So the judges were like, what do we have to do? So they were like, yeah, we're available. No problem. We're happy to talk. So it made it easier. But you're right, now that everything's in motion, it can be harder. Take a few times to schedule something. Plus, in that case, not only were people wanting to talk to people, but the audience was really interested in hearing things and listening to podcasts. So it really, I think, gave you like the edge in getting the audience to begin with.
It did. And we also had a lot to cover. I think probably our first 20 episodes, 15 of them had to deal with sort of pandemic effects, shifting over to Zoom, shifting over to remote proceedings, all of that. And that was stuff that we felt like was really important to get out, because it's not like everybody could just go to a CLE and discuss it. And so we felt like we're kind of helping do a public service by disseminating information about that for ourselves as well.
I think for me, I would say what you both said in terms of tips, but also the planning out. I think part of the reason to plan it out and to invite people to and kind of run through it and see how the episodes go, is to see if the theme works for whatever it is that you're planning to do. Like, is it broad enough or but niche enough? Like, are there enough episodes in it to make it continue and to have it be interesting? Is there room to evolve within the theme that you've chosen? And then who would be interested in this, kind of thinking about the audience? I think you kind of have to work that out and test it out and plan that out to see if there's enough room in there. And then be open to it evolving. I think that's the other thing. As it goes along, be open to it evolving, because I think that's just inherent in the medium.
Like everything else in law, it kind of ebbs and flows, as I think Jody mentioned earlier. We'll go on streaks where we'll record 3 or 4 weeks in a row and have quite a stable of episodes built up. And then it's useful to have that, especially like at the end of the year when it's harder to get people and so forth. So, but we just kind of roll with it. Whenever the opportunities come up, we'll try to schedule when people are available. And it's usually not too hard, because our version of prep, because of the way we approach our show, which is not to closely script it, we know enough about our guests to kind of be able to come up with a general outline of topics for discussion. And most of them are more than agreeable to just kind of go off an outline and then just see where the conversation takes us. That's, to me, that's kind of where the magic is. If you try to script it too closely, then it comes across as stilted. I kind of get a kick out of, every so often I'll ask a kind of pointed question of a guest, and I surprise even myself occasionally who I choose to ask pointed questions of. But our guests are almost universally very gracious about it. They understand that people want to know things. And as you said earlier, the medium kind of lends itself to that. But we have had nothing but universally good feedback from not only listeners, but our guests too. They all say, oh, I really enjoyed that experience. Even the ones that go in sort of with some trepidation.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, I've had that too. We're like, oh, I'm not so sure. And then they're like, oh, that was a good experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then you get your referrals.
And then you get referrals, right.
Right.
And I let Todd ask the hard questions. Yeah, he's the mean one. I'm the nice one.
Well, I'm not mean, but Jody is nice, so.
Yeah, you guys have the luxury. You can kind of go off each other in that regard. It's me all the time, and it's either good or bad. Hopefully people are okay with that. Hopefully people don't get too tired of that, Todd.
I think they're clearly okay with
this. Yeah, I'd say that you've been very successful with being just you.
Agreed. I'm going to throw out something for discussion before we close, because I know we're going to wrap up here shortly. But so the one question I get asked fairly often, and I think Jody does too, is, well, do you get any business out of your podcast? And I think the consensus between me and Jody is it's hard to measure it directly, but that it does. So you're putting yourself out in the world. And so I think it does help to increase, say, name recognition. People recognize you as an expert in your field. We're talking specifically about things that are at least indirectly related to being appellate lawyers. So it may be a little bit different than your focus, MC, but I'll throw in to kind of answer my own question here. I've actually started using podcast episodes more to kind of demonstrate to a potential client who's contacted me about a specific topic that I've talked to people who know some things, or I actually know some, and having had those conversations. And I've had a few people comment that's like, hey, that was really helpful. Thanks for sending that. So these are quite often non-lawyers who are the most impressed by this. Just in the last few months, I think I've noticed, maybe it's a byproduct of having over 100 episodes in the can, but usually when a phone call comes in or somebody approaches me about a new case, we've probably got a podcast episode that's relevant to that. So it's been a useful resource in that way too, even just trying to be helpful to someone that doesn't even wind up hiring you.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's sort of in the category of, hey, I wrote an article on that, or I have a blog post or something to say like, yep, hey, I have a podcast on that. That honestly never occurred to me, but I have on occasion when a trial lawyer will ask about a particular judge or something, does anybody know about Judge X, right? So there's the biographies, there's the various things you can, I'm like, well, there's a podcast where you can hear her talking about her journey that might be relevant to you. So that's the only way that I've actually responded to an inquiry with, but that's a really good point, Todd. I hadn't thought about that.
Well, and that's exactly how I have used articles I've written in the past is, oh, well, here's this article. Here's a CLE paper I wrote on this particular subject. And Jody's written his fair share of CLE papers too. So I feel confident if anybody wants to talk about some of the things that Jody's written on. It's a really nice marketing tool. I don't think podcasting in our realm is really direct marketing of any sort, but I think it does kind of elevate you, keeps you top of mind with people in some ways, which is part of the goal. You can't be super aggressive in your marketing as an appellate lawyer. You're going to drive your clientele away.
I'd say the most direct benefits I've gotten from the podcast are the insulated podcast branded mug and the two podcast embroidered shirts that I have. But you know what? It's a great mug and they're nice shirts. And
Yeah. Oh, that's so funny.
But to Todd's point, no, I definitely, there's a lot more people I can call to ask questions of or vice versa than before we started.
Yeah, exactly. I think to me, the most sort of surprising or the benefits of it are not only you get to learn about the guests, sort of the community that's created by the guests themselves, but then the community of other podcasters, like we have found, which is really neat too. So I think there's a lot of unexpected areas like that. I've also really been conscious of that community within the guest part too, so that if somebody will call me and say, oh, I heard such and such episode and I'd like to talk to Judge or whoever the guest is, because there's some similar things that I want to start something like that in my state or something. And I'll say, well, that's fine. You can just reach out to them. And no, would you introduce us? I'm like, well, sure. I mean, in many cases, like, they're both judges. They probably could just call each other, but that's fine. I'm happy to facilitate it. But just that community that's created within that is really neat.
It is. It's super neat.
So what about, we'll put a little different spin on it and ask about if you have any regrets or things you wish you'd done differently so far?
Well, I think if I knew how much work it was going to be, I might not have done it. That's what I'll say.
Yeah.
I understand that.
Yeah, that's fair, especially being the sole personality on the podcast. I'll say, I want to hear what you have to say, Jody, but I think for me, it's really not a regret. It's more of something I think I could have done differently and still might. And it has to do with that community aspect of the podcast. I think there's things you could do, I could do, to really try to develop that among our guests. It is kind of a cool thing when I send out a mug and post it on Twitter, and then suddenly I get all these messages from previous guests saying, hey, where's my mug? I'm working on it,
hey,
by the way.
That's right. Where's my mug? Wait a minute.
That's right. So that's not exactly the community thing I'm talking about, but just something as simple as just like an email list of just guests only with new episodes. And that'd be so easy for me to set up. I could do it in 10 minutes. So that's something I wish I had started from the beginning. And now if I'm going to do it now, it'd be a little more challenging, but I think it could still be done. So I haven't given up on that idea yet. I think because of that very thing you're talking about, MC, of, hey, I heard maybe they don't listen to that many podcasts. And so I also don't want to inundate our previous guests with emails either, just like I don't want to hassle clients. But that's something that I think I might give more consideration to going forward. Jody, what about you?
I don't have any regrets. I mean, honestly, this is one of my favorite things that I do. Had I known then what I know now, I think I probably could have done a better job early on, but I think that's just part of learning and experience.
I think that's part of like the early advice is just start. Like if you're waiting to make it perfect, it's like, no, kind of it happens by doing it.
Yeah, it's like drafting a brief. Sometimes you just have to get words on the paper to get started. And I feel like this is kind of that way. You learn by doing, you improve, edit, you get better. But no, I have no regrets about doing it at all or anything that we've done.
I don't mean to imply that I have any regrets. It's just something I could have done maybe a little differently. And like I said, there's maybe still time. But no, I think you're spot on.
I think that's part of the evolving process, Todd, that it just evolves. And I think that's part of it too. You have enough to have like a critical mass to have that community aspect. I've just had very particular things where people have said, oh, this particular person is my hero because she's done X and I'd really like to learn about X. And I'm like, well, feel free to use the podcast as a reason to contact her or whatever. And being able to facilitate those things. I enjoy that all the time. Anyway, facilitating connections and seeing connections between people and making that happen. I enjoy that, whether it's through the podcast or otherwise. So it's just another way to do that and to have connection even with people that you've known before, but you haven't talked to in a while. I think the podcast is one way to do that as well. And certainly people that I've caught up with, having them as guests on the podcast.
Sure. Yeah, that is a lot of fun. That is one of the more rewarding things about it, I would say, is being able to show the rest of the world somebody that you was got a lot of valuable things in their head and thoughts and getting them to share them.
Yeah, exactly. So. Like wanting to shine a light on them and elevate them and to share how awesome they are with the world kind of thing. It's neat that you're able to have the platform to do that through podcasting now. It's pretty cool. All right. So thanks so much, you guys, for sharing this and having this discussion. It's been a lot of fun. As always, the seamless, fun discussion with both of you. And but for the podcast, your podcast, I would not have met you. So I'm very grateful for your podcast for that reason alone. Plus, it's super high quality. So, all right. I usually end with lightning round questions, but I'm just going to ask one question of both of you, which is, what is your motto if you have one?
Got to think for a second. You can put the Jeopardy theme song on.
Jeopardy music.
I can jump in here and say it's maybe two things that I've tried to really think about, the two concepts. One is, and it's directly related to our conversation, just a one word thought, simplify. And related to that is, these are just things, this is self-talk, right? Another one is stay focused, because we are just full of distractions in the world. So I am not particularly good at either of those, but I'm trying to get better.
I don't know that I have a motto, but I guess one of my principles that I try to always live by is be kind to yourself and be kind to others, because you just never know what people are going through.
That's good. Okay. MC, what is your motto?
I knew you were going to ask me that.
We can't. I mean, this is a back and forth thing. We can't have it.
I know. Well, I think of it as my mom has various things that she would send to me, sort of quotes and inspiring things. And I think that she just would always tells me, like, sort of make this the best day ever, and that paint the canvas of the day the way you want to. And I think of that way as each day is a new day to start over and to think about that, like, hey, it may have been a tough day yesterday, but today we're just going to move forward fresh and start over, and it could be a better day. And also not to forget to sort of make your mark on the world and to do what you think is important. So both of those are things I think about a lot.
Yeah, I like it. Well, thanks for having us. We sure appreciate it.
Yes, thank you so much. And congrats on 100 episodes.
That's right.
Yeah, thanks so much, you guys. And I really appreciate your joining, and have a great day.
You too.
You too.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, presented by Butler Snow. If you're enjoying the show, please recommend it to your colleagues or leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. We appreciate everyone who has rated the show and otherwise supported us so far. To stay in touch, suggest topics, ask questions, or express interest in coming on the show, visit us online at texapplawpod.com or tweet us at texapplawpod. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.